Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Azar Nafisi, whose latest book is The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. Azar Nafisi is the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, Things I've Been Silent About, Anti-Terror, A Critical Study of Vladimir Nabokov. And by the way, I went online to find out how to pronounce that name. You know what I found out?
Huh.
They said Vladimir Nabokov or Vladimir Nabokov.
Well, you can't get clearer than that.
No, so however anybody wants to pronounce it, we now know what it is. And a children's book called Bibi and the Green Voice. And you're a fellow at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. You teach literature there, is that correct?
Well, I had been teaching literature, but also the relationship between literature and politics. But for the past few years, I have been wandering around the country talking about books and writing books.
And that's what we're going to talk about, because that's, in fact, what The Republic of Imagination is about. As I was reading this particular book, the two previous books I've read were Nora Webster by Colm Tobin and The Zone of Interest by Martin Amis. And in many respects, a book like Republic of Imagination talks about the importance of these sorts of novels. Mm-hmm. One is a strange sort of Holocaust comedy, and the other is a serious novel about the nature of grief.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that what these books do in their own way is exactly what books like Huck Finn, Babbitt, Heart is a Lonely Hunter, which you discuss, do in their own way. And that's the importance, I guess, of fiction?
Don't get me started on the importance of fiction. It is not about the importance of fiction. It is that I think from the dawn of man, we had needed stories in order to understand and satisfy our curiosity for the unknown. And an imaginative knowledge like science is all about discovering the world while you simultaneously discover yourself. And it's about change. I cannot imagine us surviving as human beings without fiction, without the complexity, ambiguity, and the paradoxes that fiction brings to our attention.
Why do you think literature, in that sense, is set apart from, say, watching a television show or a film? Even, we're talking about the best of the lot.
You know, when I was talking about Republic of Imagination, I believe that all works of imagination, including music and arts, and of course, when we talk about literary forms, there's drama and there is poetry, all of them are included. What fiction claims, which I think in a sense is the boldest claim, is its competition with reality. The fact that it is focused on individuals in various levels of interaction, beginning with the personal, going through the social and political, and the universal human level. And so it shows you the thickness, the messiness of life, and also because it deals so directly with reality, it a lot of times subverts and exposes it. And I love that relevance, fiction enduringly keeps about showing us to ourselves, exposing us to ourselves.
George Lakoff talked about how metaphor comes in through the back door, that we don't change in a straightforward argument, but we do change through this other method, through this other space.
I think that in a sense, imaginative words are born because we are so inarticulate about the deepest feelings and emotions and encounters in life. And that is why you need metaphor, because nowadays, you know, in Common Core standards, it's very fashionable to talk about informational texts. Well, informational texts or informational kind of exchange doesn't articulate. It only gives you certain information. And that is why human beings need fiction, because they need to shape the world and renew it through shaping it.
Colm Tobin said at one point that in Ireland, theater and literature play a much more important role than they do, say, in America.
Yes.
Based upon what you say in reading Lolita in Tehran and in Republic Imagination, they play a much greater role in Iran as well. I asked him why in Ireland, and he said, well, because we're a small country. Is that it?
No, it's not just it. Actually, it is amazing that you mentioned that, because I was just last night talking about this in one of my talks. And I had been to Dublin last September. And, you know, that was the first time I was there. And I thought, oh, my God, this is a nation whose monuments are created through words. There are very few monuments, like when you go to Paris or Rome or London, you know, but they created out of words. They were a nation that was suppressed by the British. They were a nation who were told that they should not even be literate, because people were... And what did they do? How did they get back at the British? By taking over the language and turning it into monuments that are now called British literature, but it is so Irish. And I thought, what would the British Empire do without the Irish and the Scottish and the Wales and India and Canada? Because they're the ones that took this language and run away with it. And that is why poets are important, because poets are important to the... I was there when Seamus Heaney had just died, and they acted exactly like we do. You know, in Iran, my father always used to tell me that the identity of Iranians, because we're so ancient and we've been constantly raped and ravaged and conquered, he said that our identity is in our poetry. That is the only continuous thing that we have. And all Iranian mythology and history and desires and aspirations are told through its poetry. Our streets are named after our great poets. We have statues to the shahs and to the rulers that come down after a while, but the statues to the poets that this regime tried to bring down, it couldn't, you know.
This regime could not.
Could not. They wanted to bring down the statue of our epic poet Ferdowsi, who wrote in 11th century about, you know, Iranian mythology right until the Islamic period. They couldn't. Khayyam, who is an agnostic poet who talks about wine and fickleness of life, they wanted to change the name of the street. They couldn't. Now they have to pay homage to these people because, as Nabokov says, governments come and go, only the trace of genius remains, and the poets know this.
You spent 18 years in Iran after the mullahs came in, teaching literature in it so far as you could. What's the situation there now? Are they reading a book like reading Lolita in Tehran there?
They are. Of course, I understand that, you know, I'm not, advertising or promoting repression, you know, for reading. But the point is that the Iranian youth have found a way of connecting to the world that is physically cut off from them. And that is through its literature and arts and philosophy. I mean, Hannah Arendt is very popular in Iran. How many of my students know Hannah Arendt, you know? And about my books... You know, I had not used Twitter and social media until a few months ago. There's a story behind that. But anyway, I get tweets from Tehran about books and emails. That is how you connect to the world. And you don't need to pass physical boundaries. You break the boundaries. You know, you resist the boundaries by reading and listening to music and looking at the art.
Well, you just said that up until recently there's a story there. What's the story?
Well, with social media for a long time, I didn't know what to do. And then I also didn't like what many people were doing with it, because I felt that it is taking control over everyone's lives and taking the attention away from the substance of life. And then I was in Nashville giving a talk, and this young man, Michael, who was a student, he came to me and he said, you know, because people make things, your Facebook or, you know, there was a Twitter in my name. And he said, you know, your name in social media is a mess. And I'm going to come there and help you create the Republic of Imagination. And it was really strange. And he came, and we talked about it. And then what I realized was that the gadgets, iPad or iPhone, all of these are obviously instruments that I can use, and it will control me if I either ignore it or not control it. And I want to use it to connect to the world the way I want. I love books. I want to find other readers. And so for the past few months, I have been sort of using it and connecting.
I'm a little surprised that it took you so long, because the Arab Spring, Tahrir Square, that came about, and Occupy as well, whatever the outcomes.
Oh, yeah.
They came about because social media existed.
And don't forget, before that, it was Iran in 2009 elections when people protested. They called that a Twitter revolution for the first time. I had realized, and I myself had used it during the Tehran for the purposes. One of the things that one of my former Iranian students told me, he said, you know, we existed and we were fighting before the Twitter, and we were doing it afterwards, and we fell out of fashion and somebody else took over. So what I realized was that that is what I mean, that you should control it, that when something happens in the world and you want the rest of the world to know or to come to the streets, you use it. When you want people to discuss something on a national or international level, you use it. But the fact that you allow to be consumed by it. In this book, I talk about Babbitt, who is sort of the symbol of consumer society. When I first read Babbitt, I was in college. And I was laughing and saying, yeah, American society, you know, these people. This time I read, it was much more frightening, because I recognized that I could be Babbitt, you know, that all of those queues in front of the Apple store, staying up until midnight, it is not just about what you were describing about Arab Springs or Occupy. It is just getting the latest gadget. And that is where one wants to use social media to defeat that kind of attitude. It is the attitude that matters more than the instruments.
Which brings us back to your book, Azar Nafisi, The Republic of Imagination. There are five essays. The first essay is just an introduction, which has a very key point, which is that in Iran, literature is so much more important than it is here. Section one concerns Huck Finn, though actually it's the story of your friend Farah. Section two concerns Babbitt and our consumer society, but again, it's actually the story of Common Core and the rant about Common Core. Then Carson McCullers, which again is not just about Hart as the Lonely Hunter, but is also about the radicalism of yesterday compared to today. And your final section, which is about individualism, which is the story of James Baldwin. I know that you started with like 23 books and honed it down, but in essence, what you're doing in these is you're basically telling stories as well.
Yes, I can't help it. You know, that Huck chapter, I wrote 100 pages straight literary on Huck, and I reread it. I sent it to my editor, and I reread it, and I thought, oh, my God, this chapter has no heart. This is just me spouting, and some people are great in not bringing narrative. I'm not, you know, putting them down. And I told my editor, I said, I can't give this. And she said, I didn't want to tell you, but I didn't like it too much either. So the point with me, it has become an obsession with me that so many people talk about the fact that fiction is not relevant to reality. And I wanted to say that fiction is relevant to reality, not because it gives a message, not because it tells you who to go and vote for, all of these ideological expectations that we have from fiction. Colm Tobin doesn't do any of that. But fiction is relevant to your life because, as Baldwin says, fiction is important because life is important. They are like siblings. They're twins. You need fiction in order to understand life, and you need life in order to be able to imagine. And I wanted to show this intersection of reality and fiction and how each transforms into the other.
It's also true that the first thing that a totalitarian regime tries to do is stop fiction.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You're right on the mark, you know. And sometimes I think, you know, these totalitarians, because they're all really bad fiction makers. They're like those bad authors who try to impose their own ideology on all the characters, and they've shut down all the voices. Now, a tyrant, the first thing he wants to do is to make all voices being trimmed down to his voice. All images be made in the image that he imposes. And what is it that is mocking him and telling him, you're not going to get me, you know? It is fiction. It is a celebration of individual, but not the kind of individualism we hear today, that this is a dog-eat-dog world and each for his own and all this Donald Trumpian type of individualism. It is Huckian individualism, which is the relationship, the connection. You grow up, you become yourself through connecting to others, through interaction to others. And that is what tyrants are afraid of. Their first targets are women, minorities, and imagination. They closed down humanities in Iran. They didn't close down engineering departments. And I'm not against engineers. My husband and my son are both engineers, and they're in love with Great Gatsby and with James Baldwin and McCullers. So engineers read too.
But, you know, the other side of it is that this is a good thing, I guess, but in the long run, that sort of totalitarian perspective doesn't work. I mean, the moment that the Soviet Union fell, it vanished. And after 35 years, it hasn't stopped Iran. It doesn't work, and yet they keep trying.
Yes, they will try. It is in human nature. I think we carry the best and the worst in us. And that is why, you know, Sinclair Lewis has this book called It Can't Happen Here. He's talking about fascism. It's a satire on the fact that it can happen here. That is why freedom is not something that you have and then you go home and sleep and say, I'll be free forever. Freedom is, as Saul Bellow said, an ordeal. And that ordeal of freedom means that at any moment, somebody is sitting there waiting to get it away from you. In a country like Iran right now, a regime like the Islamic Republic does it by torturing you and executing you and putting you to death. In a country like America, we don't do this. Ray Bradbury said, you don't destroy a culture only by burning the books. You can destroy it by getting people not to read. So what we do here is indifference, is the happy pills we give everybody so that they don't care. And that is the moment of danger. And that is why I wanted to write this book, because we're living in this very exciting moment of danger right now.
In the Guardian interview, you said, when I came to the United States, I realized how the ideal of freedom is being eroded. One canary in the mine is the denigration of ideas, the inequality of the U.S. education system, and privilege goes to private schools.
Yes, I believe, and since everybody is fond of talking about founders, I believe that Washington, Adams, and Madison, and Jefferson also believed it. So did Frederick Douglass, and I don't know, most probably Abraham Lincoln. The whole point about a democratic society, I think it is the duty of the public and the duty of a democratic society to provide for every citizen a good public education. Now, if those citizens do not take advantage of that public education, then we can blame them. But we cannot blame them if, when they go to our public schools, they have teachers that are underrated and overworked. We have school principals who do not have enough funding, so they cut art and music and poetry from the classes. And then instead of that, bring a rigidity to the class that only encourages our students to go into vocations and be career ready rather than work based on passion and on meaning. And I think that that is a very, very serious danger sign, and I will fight it.
Jim Harrison, when I interviewed him a couple of years ago, had written a novel, and one of his characters is an ex-teacher who said, and he's asked, why did you quit? And he said, because I didn't feel like teaching children how to be employees.
That is exactly it. And, you know, this obsession with China, even our president constantly saying, we are behind China in math. And, well, okay, let's look at China. China right now has reached a point, a dead end in education, because they've realized that they have been teaching science and technology without passion. While we know that the greatest science and technologists are like Einstein and Steve Jobs, Einstein said, knowledge is limited, imagination encircles the world. That is how they saw it. So what China is trying to do is coming to America, in fact, and trying to find out about our liberal colleges models. They won't be able to do it, but there's this great debate in China right now about American-style liberal college teaching. And now America is becoming more like China. We're taking the liberal arts out of the colleges, and we forget that in American schools, science and humanities are together and not separate.
And this comes back to this common core, which those of us without children who don't teach don't know that much about, but what we're looking at is an entire generation being taught on the basis of standardized tests. And it seemed to me the most important part of my years at a public school in New York City, which was a good public school, was learning critical thinking.
Yes. And what kills me, they call what they do critical thinking. I think that our education system needs reform, and with changing times and changing technology, we need to change. So none of us are saying, let's not change. Let's go back to 50 years ago. What we are saying is that you need to have students who want to take risks, to be innovators. If you frighten them and say to them, all you have to do is to find a job. Even our president is saying that art historians don't make enough money, you know, go and get a job. What you're doing is you're creating citizens who would not innovate because they don't want to take risks, who would not want to give to the society because they don't want to give. It's all take, who would not sacrifice for their country in any way, who would not be empathetic towards the world or curious about the world, and then you would not have America. Are we going to be boasting about ourselves as the greatest country in the world because of the military might? These terrorist thugs in ISIS and ISIL, they can mock our military might. A country is great because of its culture. A country is great when tyrants and thugs are afraid of its democratic culture. If it loses its love of its culture and history, I think, as Saul Bellow said, it will be facing death.
The other way to look at it, from a negative perspective,
yes,
again, but another way to look at it is that if the stick is you won't get a job and you'll bring America down, the carrot is if you become an employee, you'll make a lot of money. If you become an artist, you won't.
You'd mentioned Colm Tobin, and every time I hear his name, I remember his first novel, which I fell in love with, Master Henry James. Henry James, one of the characters in The Ambassadors, has a great quotation. She says it in praise to the hero of the book. She says, "You are a perfectly equipped failure." And this is the whole point of the good part of America for me, that people say, like Huck Finn, they say, all right then, I'll do the right thing and I go to hell. Because the point is not success at any cost. The point is to do the thing that your heart and your principles tell you is the right thing to do, and to actualize something that seems impossible, something that nobody has ever done before. What do our children want the money for? What will they do if there is no meaning in the money that they get?
They'll stand in line at Apple is what they'll
do. They stand in line at Apple. And do we think that people who intellectually are so lazy will then be innovating things the way our innovators have done it? You think universities that are in the control of either corporations or foreign governments pouring money into them will work for the love of knowledge? Or do we now think that knowledge is not power? You know, these are all the questions that I think we need to ask ourselves. If we don't define what kind of American we want to be, somebody else will. And so we don't have much choice here.
And this comes from somebody who has chosen to become an American
citizen.
That
is why it matters to me. You know, when I decided to become an American, this is how I looked at it. I said that when you choose a home, you love it, and because you love something, you start grumbling about it. Because, you know, if I come through Berkeley and go home, I say, oh, it's a lovely city, or no, Washington, D.C. is better. But if I live in Berkeley, I look at the streets and say, no, I don't want it this way. This should be that way. I was grumbling about America day and night, and I thought, it's time I became an American. Maybe I'm already an American. And I believe what Mark Twain says about patriotism, that patriotism is supporting your country all of the time, supporting your government when it deserves. So I told myself, look, you chose this country. If you don't know this country and you don't define this country, you can't blame anyone else for the things that you don't like. And I'm now taking responsibility not only for the things that I love, but for the things that I don't.
Azar Nafisi, when you're reading a novel, what do you look at as you're reading it? What do you look at?
You know, every time I read a novel, I feel like Alice in Wonderland. I feel like, oh, there's this white rabbit, and it speaks, and it's not like any other white rabbit. Let me run after it. So the only thing that I expect is the unexpected. I want to jump into that hole without any preconceptions, and I want something that will give me the joy of revelation. And also the pain of revelation, because joy and pain are so close. And again, today in our society, we try to, you know, sort of hide the pain. We have become this Botox sort of nation that doesn't want to see the lines, doesn't want to see death, doesn't want to see pain.
You know, I'm not sure about that because I watch television and it's there all the time. And in fact, you know, when people talk about censorship to protect children in books, I'm kind of astonished because...
Yes.
They could just turn on their television and they'll see it anyway.
That is very true, but that sort of pain, the way television shows it and the news, they love it, is the kind that becomes a kind of addiction. It doesn't get under your skin. I always feel that it makes me like a voyeur, as if I'm looking into somebody else's window, a nosy person like the reality shows. But the novel is resilient. It shows you pain in order to confront it, not in order to give into it and lay back on your couch and watch people kill one another. Sex and violence, they keep talking about, it's become a cliche. But when the news becomes a cliche, one should start worrying.
Well, you also wind up becoming inured to it. It
yes.
doesn't have any meaning anymore.
It doesn't, because you notice what we're doing. I mean, we're drinking wine or talking with one another and somebody is getting killed. Then after that, we go out and we go to a fish restaurant with our friends, you know. But when I read Primo Levi, I didn't do any of these things. When I read Primo Levi, I wanted to go into my room and think. And when I read him, I felt that I'm ashamed somehow, as if I was implicated in the crimes that happened before I was born.
And in fact, you know, that's the reason why Martin Amis wrote Zone of Interest, is because of Primo Levi, because he felt he wanted to get to the root of what the Nazis did. And you can't really, because we
no.
can't get to that place, but we can kind of try, and maybe if we try, we learn ourselves how to be more human.
No, you're right, and Martin Amis is so mischievously good at doing this, because you know that his mischief comes not out of lightness, but it comes out of really feeling almost too frustrated about what happened to even write about it. And I think that for a writer, that is at least some of my writing, which I'm not comparing to Amis, I want you to understand that.
Right.
My writing came because I was obsessed, and I felt that my silence makes me implicated. As Baldwin says, he hates innocence. He says innocent is a crime. You need to know.
Is that the reason, one of the reasons behind writing, reading Lolita in Tehran?
That was one of the reasons, especially when I came here. When I left Iran, my mother especially, but many people, my mother kept telling me, tell them. And a lot of people were saying, when you go there, will you? And I, you know, I knew it. That was the feeling I had when people would come to visit us, that you feel so much less alone when others know what is happening to you. And I felt that, okay, I'm here and I can tell them. And if I don't tell them, then why am I here? It was also the absolute ignorance about Iran. The fact that Iran is still associated mainly with the government. In Iran, people don't associate America mainly with its government. But over here, Mr. Rouhani or Mr. Ahmadinejad become symbols of all the Iranian people.
Are your books in Farsi?
Well, I have had the privilege and the honor that the Islamic Republic, having censored my books, none of these books have been translated. I've heard that truncated versions of them, translations of them, are in Iran. People Xerox them usually or take them to Iran.
I asked Richard Flanagan, who just won the Booker Prize, I asked him about whether living in Tasmania gave him a certain perspective being far away from the rest of the world in terms of reading literature and in terms of viewing the world. He said, well, actually, no, because literature itself put him in the world. Do you feel that way about people in Tehran?
You know, that is one of the best ways of explaining it. I usually say it connected us to the world. I talk about it in my book, that my father, by telling me stories one day from Italy, the next day from France, the next day from America, the next day from Iran or Turkey, he brought the world into our little home. And when I went to these places, I had already been there through their works of fiction. And that is one other reason why fiction is so important. Brodsky used to say that, you know, he would love to vote for a president who had read Dickens, you know, because they don't understand, these policymakers, that how much fiction and history together will help them understand these cultures and not act the way they are doing as you and I speak.
I remember talking not too long ago with a Berkeley activist who said, oh, I like your program. But he was a 9/11 person, a truther type, and his perspective seemed to be what, you do what you want, but it's kind of irrelevant. And I kept thinking to myself, what I do is irrelevant?
It is amazing how things that are really the most relevant to our survival as human beings seem irrelevant, but things like making loads of money seems very relevant. Right. Or someone like Donald Trump seems much more pragmatic than an artist. I always tell people about Frederick Douglass saying that you need to be educated with your hands and your mind. That is pragmatism.
A 9/11 truther who's OCD about 9/11, the perspective, I think, is really that you're talking about things that are made up. Well, yeah. Let's not talk about whether that's made up, but let's assume for a second that it wasn't made up and that he's onto something. Even if we assume that, still, the fact is that it is real, even if it's fiction.
Well, you know, how much of reality is really, quote-unquote, real? I mean, I have gone through a war and a revolution, and I have realized how easy it is to lose everything that you called real, everything that you called home. In 1 second, it can all go up in the air. You know, we create routines because otherwise there will be a void. Now, what fiction does, it goes beyond the veneer of security that we have and makes us insecure because we understand how much more complex the world is than we think and how much more complex we are. And we are unexpected. And that is why these poor writers keep saying, we reveal the truth.
It also, speaking back to Republic of Imagination, is, I think, what links your friend Farah, who had to escape Iran and lost everything in the process, to someone like Huck Finn.
To someone like Huck Finn. I mean, that is the miracle of fiction, that a woman who doesn't live the same times, the same country, didn't speak the same language at the beginning, the person that at the end of her life she goes to is a little fictional boy called Huck Finn. And the way that people get fired up over these books, they get much more fired up over Tom and Jim and Huck than they get about their own relatives and real people in life. It is amazing to me that we mistake the word illusion for imagination. Imagination without reality doesn't exist, but illusion is what is unreal.
Changing the topic slightly, there's mention in Republic of Imagination about literary folks still putting down genre fiction. Now, I remember that from 30 years ago. Dates me, but I remember that from 30 years ago. But then when I think about, say, Chandler's The Big Sleep, which to me is the great American novel, not Huck Finn, which comes close. But when I think about people like Atwood, Lessing, Pynchon, younger writers like Chabon or Leatham, they're all writing in a way in genre fiction.
They do. They do. Even some of Nabokov's novels are written in that genre. I think that it comes, not to everybody, because some people just don't like genre. I can accept that. But some people who look down on it, you know, I feel that they're the kind of people who feel insecure. You feel much more secure if you talk about quote-unquote intellectual form of fiction or novel of ideas. You belong to an elite group. But once you get down to the nitty-gritty of Chandler, nowadays I'm reading ton of French, for example, then, you know, you might be thrown out of that group and become popular. I always remind people, you know, where did Dickens write from? Who came to watch Aeschylus? How was the globe filled with people? And their estimation of readers, it bothers me a great deal.
Well, there's also the idea of people going in and out of fashion, and I found it fascinating in Republic of Imagination that the four authors you chose, in particular Lewis, McCullers, and Baldwin, and maybe to a lesser extent Twain, but even maybe Twain as well, these are people who were in a way out of fashion.
I chose them for two reasons. One was I wanted to end this book, not go further than 1960s, because I felt that was a new period and the fiction in that period is very different. And the second thing was because I wanted to show that, as Ezra Pound used to say, literature is news that remains news. I wanted them to read Babbitt and realize how much of their own lives and feelings and emotions they will find in Babbitt. That is the difference between us as human beings who will die and the conclusive evidence that we have lived is fiction.
What about writers who are out of fashion now, who we don't even hear about, people like John O'Hara?
Actually, I was one of those snobs before who hadn't read John O'Hara properly, and I did this time for this book.
And?
Wow! The spaciousness and at the same time the concreteness and the American characters that he creates, they are amazing. I wish I had, the room and space to read it. And some of the others I had chosen were like Nathaniel West's The Day of Locusts.
Great book.
You know, it is a fantastic, Nathaniel West is so relevant today. Of course, Flannery O'Connor, we always, all of us love, you know. Right. I wanted to talk about Melville's Confidence Man, because people don't remember Confidence Man. I wasn't after well-known novels. I was after novels that for me have endured, that but have been, like Sinclair Lewis, even maligned in their own times.
Azar Nafisi, your blog on your website asks people, what's the most influential book of your childhood and why? Are you planning to compile that at some point?
I was thinking about that. Actually, one of the reasons that I now have this website is to create a true and free exchange about different stages where books have really seriously influenced us. Because, you know, I go on these trips, and during the signing of the books, people come and tell you the most amazing stories. And you know, people have tears in their eyes about books that change their lives. And I look at them, and for me, over past 17 years I have come back to this country, what has brought hope to me is this community of readers, the community of very humane Americans that we don't see in the news, that we don't see on the stage. I want us to exchange these stories and to have a national conversation. Who's going to bail out imagination and thought?
And that's azarnafisi.com.
Yes, it is.
Azar Nafisi. Okay, now this book has come out. What have you got on tap?
Writing, you mean? First of all, this book took me about 10 years to write, right after. So I'm sort of right now breathing a little bit before I move on. To tell you the truth, I don't have the foggiest right now. I really don't.
You've been listening to an interview with Azar Nafisi, whose latest book is titled The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.